So welcome to lecture 12. It's February 23rd. Lovely day outside. I'm surprised anybody's here today. You aren't outside enjoying the weather. Although tomorrow I understand it's going to turn bad. But lecture notes page 106. Today I remembered to bring the right housekeeping slides. You remember on Tuesday I did not bring the full version. So when you're thinking ahead to mini test 6, et cetera, be sure to view the corrected housekeeping slides in Canvas that does have the full and right information for mini test 6. Okay? Any questions on that? Sorry about the error on my side. So we know that midterm 1 is up and running. Currently, average score is 75%. That's not bad. Keep it up. Yay, you. And it's open through Wednesday. Closes when? 5 p.m. Not 11:59. 5 p.m. 5 p.m. All right. Also, on this regular schedule, so this is that busy time period I was talking about, Mini Test 6 will open on Friday. It'll close Tuesday. So you got to think both sides of the midterm. Midterm 1 leading towards midterm 2. Don't forget each of those. We know that PACBACK number 3, not PACBACK, the extra credit number 3 will close on its regular schedule. So that would be tonight and on the regular schedule. Extra credit number 4 will open tomorrow and close on Thursday. More stuff to think about. Don't be distracted. Make sure you got it all in mind. On the calendar. Any questions for me about the calendar items that we've been talking about that should be clear but somebody isn't quite getting it? We're all good, okay. I have no longer bothered putting the details up here, but if you want to see the details about midterm 1 exam, look in the about the course testing materials on Canvas. If you haven't taken one of these tests before, take the sample proctorial world history quiz in the proctorial help module just to see how it works. And last time I did have here, no code is necessary. If it asks you for a code, it's lying. Turn your machine off, reboot, have nothing else running. See if that fixes the asking for a code problem. Midterm grades will be posted after this midterm is done. So this is not your everyday B2C company. You don't know, probably, Micmac. Micmac is a B2B company with a vast array of U.S. clients. So they're working domestically right now, offering a lot of e-commerce services, to keep it simple, to a large number of retailers. They've decided to grow by acquiring Swavin. So Micmac, a U.S.-based B2B e-commerce platform, is going global, we're talking about global currently, in a particular way, by acquiring Swavin, a Paris-based e-commerce enablement and analytics software company. So we're seeing a bit about a corporate growth strategy, a bit about how to do global marketing. This acquisition will open up markets in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, EMEA, if you ever see the jargon for it, Asia Pacific, APAC, and Latin America, which Swavin currently serves. The deal will expand Micmac's reach to include more than 3,000 retailers across 20 industries in 80 countries. That seems to be going global in a big way. They could have had other ways to go global. We'll talk about some of those later on, but they decided to do it through acquisition. Rachel Tipograph, who's Micmac's founder, said, if you look at Amazon, they have an extremely global footprint. Sephora is aggressively making moves into India. Then you have Alibaba. These players are becoming more global, and these big brands really want to be able to understand their customers, their channels, have real-time learning, which is what Micmac does for them. So the B2B customers are going global. So are we as a provider of services to you, which is one of the reasons we said last time about going global. Your customers are going global. They want you to go global too. Yeah? So cool global example in the news right now. This next one, remember day one I said something about this being the weird, wild, wacky, wonderful world of marketing? This falls in that category. Starbucks is going to have an entirely new line of coffee with a spoonful of olive oil in every cup. Did anybody happen to follow the social media TikTok thing about putting olive oil in your diet every day? Maybe you saw it. Okay, well, this sort of picks up on that, although that isn't the only reason they're doing it. So Starbucks wants you to give olive oil coffee a shot, arc, arc, arc. So this is a new product introduction.
And Starbucks is adding an unexpected ingredient to its newest cup of joe. The coffee chain is introducing a new line of drinks made with a spoonful of extra virgin olive oil. Starbucks will make the new beverages available at its cafes in Italy this week. Of course, versions will then hit Southern California this spring. Starbucks says the drinks will eventually go global sometime this year.
So this also ties in the idea of global as well. So the coffee chain is rolling out a new line of beverages made with extra virgin olive oil. Each drink is truly made with a spoonful of oil, adding 120 calories to your daily cup of coffee. Three olive oil beverages debuted yesterday at the company's 25 Starbucks cafes in Italy. I digress to say, if you'd asked me before I read this particular article how many Starbucks there were in Italy, I would have said none. They couldn't get a foothold. And that was true for a lot of years. The Italians resisted Starbucks. Things change. Here we are. They now have 25 cafes in Italy. So each of these drinks includes Oleto, Starbucks word for the new line, in its name. So here's a new brand name. We'll talk later on. We talk about product, about brand names. Oleto is their choice for their new product. Versions of those drinks will arrive in Southern California this spring, with more details about the U.S. launch to come. They'll roll out in other markets, in the U.K., the Middle East, and Japan this year. So again, their global marketing strategy for product launch of this new drink. It's one of the biggest launches we've had in decades, said Brady Brewer. That's a funny name for a coffee guy, Brewer. Starbucks chief marketing officer. Rather than a flavor or a product, it's really a platform, he said, meaning the customers will be able to use olive oil to customize some of their drinks. So again, new product rolling out. The company said this new inspiration came from a family tradition that has existed in regions of Italy for generations. Enjoying a spoonful of extra virgin olive oil each day as an uplifting ritual. This is actually a cultural difference, because as far as I know, most Americans don't have a spoonful of olive oil in their drink, but apparently it was a big deal, I think, in southern Italy. Howard Schultz, who comes and goes there as their CEO periodically, went to Italy, had this idea, and has brought it now to fruition as the company's newest line. Starbucks olive oil coffee comes as the company continues to navigate a tough macro environment. Though interim CEO Howard Schultz has maintained optimism, so again, the impact of crest factors on businesses and marketing, in this case economic. To be sure, Starbucks has raised prices about 5% to offset inflation, but Schultz says he doesn't expect any more increases. So again, the impact of crest factors on our marketing mix, economic factors causing us to raise our price. The company has seen sagging international sales after a resurgence in COVID cases in China led to shrinking demand in that market. Going forward, Schultz is anticipating a rebound for China and for consumer demand at large. So global marketing, its impact on us, and forecasting consumer behavior. We'll see what happens. How many of you guys are chomping at the bit to have a nice new spoonful of olive oil in your coffee? No?
My dad thinks
they don't know what a cortado is. Your dad what?
Does it? They don't know what a cortado is.
Well, there you go. If they don't know what a cortado, how many of you guys know what a cortado is? Yeah, how can they not know? What's a cortado? I think that's a Boilermaker. No, no.
That's... I'm too scared to ask.
Well, you're going to have to ask him if this improves his image of their brand. He may say, yes, that's exactly what they've needed. Let me know. We pick up with lecture notes page 106 and page 180 in the textbook, continuing chapter 7, Understanding and Reaching Global Consumers and Markets. And we had been wandering through this notion of various trends in global marketing. We had ended up with this idea of countries in the world, the WTO, etc. We answered there are 196, but 150 in the WTO and 195 if you don't count Taiwan. So, as we heard, Patrick Lowe was talking about, the chief economist, ex-retired chief economist of the World Trade Organization, about This idea of economic integration, various regional agreements where people work together, countries work together. One of those is, one you've heard of certainly, the European Union. It consists of 27 countries with more than 440 million consumers. And you heard about Brexit, right? You realize that Britain left the EU in 2020. Not going exactly how they hoped, but okay. It's hard to appreciate sitting here post-creation of the EU how difficult it was to do business in Europe previously. You got 27 countries each with its own set of tax, tariffs, business rules, currencies, each with its own separate market system. And you're trying to do business in this little constrained area of Europe. It was cray-cray. This has made life much easier for all those entities inside those 27 countries. Of course, it is a little exclusionary. If you want to bring product into the EU, there's going to be some sort of tariff or some sort of tax or some sort of duty fee on it, which leads, of course, to American companies want to set up in Europe, so they avoid that. It operates as an internal single market that allows free movement of goods, capital, services, and people between those member states. Quite a difference. Again, I tell stories you don't want to hear because I'm an old man. I remember the first time I went between France and Germany, and nobody stopped me at the border to look for a passport. It was like, what? But it's all one big system. You can freely travel without showing your passport. Wow. They always make fun that American students can't find anything on a map, so I thought I'd show you a map of Europe. So that's Europe over there. And the blue, of course, is the EU countries. What's the, whatever that is, yellow or orange? Britain. Why are they different? Because they're outside of the EU. They Brexited. And what's that funny little gray thing in the middle of the blue? Yeah. Switzerland. Why is Switzerland a funny little gray thing in the middle of the blue? Well, they don't belong to the EU. Why wouldn't Switzerland belong to the EU? They love their neutrality. They love their banking system that isn't part of the EU banking system. They love their privacy and secrecy rules around their banking system. They're perfectly happy and doing okay for themselves not being part of the EU. So they love that idea of neutrality, and it lets them do things that the EU wouldn't let them do. So that's Switzerland in the middle. Have you been? Is that how you know? You just know it. All right, another view of it, same thing. Showing you the EU map without Britain and Switzerland at the center. Another example of a rise of economic integration is the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement. It took effect in July of 2020, replacing what? NAFTA. Okay, the North American Free Trade, whatever it was, Association. Oh, there we go. Free Trade Agreement. Though NAFTA is officially expired, governments and companies are still adjusting to the new rules under the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, most notably the new labor provisions, so that those treaties take a while to work out. The coronavirus has also complicated the implementation as manufacturers are adapting to new guidelines in the middle of a global economic crisis. Here we are with the visual. And as I alluded to, I think, last time, given all the changes in trade relations and troubles between the U.S. and China, China is now opening up a bunch of companies in Mexico in order to be creating goods within the North United States-Mexico-Canada agreement. They avoid the tariffs, they avoid the duties, they avoid the taxes of coming in from somebody outside this economic integration. Asia free trade agreements, the South Asian free trade area, an agreement that created a free trade zone covering more than 1.8 billion people, admittedly not high income earners, all of them, but still a lot of people, in India, Pakistan, Nepal, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Bhutan, and the Maldives. And so that's another integration sort of situation. And the East Asian free trade agreement on services, the other one focused mostly on products. So a theme throughout the world are these integrated groups of countries working together. visually. So, how in the world are we going to compete in this interesting global environment? Well, there are a variety of ways to do that, yeah? So, who are we up against? How might we compete? One approach to competition is to engage in strategic alliances. Here we're going to have a couple of independent companies that agree to work together for their own benefit, you know, for the benefit of each, in achieving their common goals. So, for example, you want to sell your cereal in Great Britain. What do you know about the Great Britain consumer, about their taste? Does anybody there know your name? You're going to spend a lot of money to get going. I wonder if there's anybody over there that already is doing this sort of stuff. Well, how about Nestle's? Do we know the name Nestle's? Yeah. Does the rest of the world know Nestle's? Yes. Does Great Britain know Nestle's? Yes. Where's Nestle's headquartered? What was your last country you talked to me about? Switzerland. Very good. In Switzerland. So they're a European country. So breakfast cereals are an example of a strategic alliance between Nestle's and General Mills. So when we think Cheerios, we don't think Nestle's. Nestle's breakfast cereals are manufactured by Cereal Partners, a joint venture strategic alliance between Nestle's and General Mills. Cereal Partners is one of the UK's leading cereal manufacturers and also makes many of the leading UK retailer brand cereals as well. You'll recognize many of our well-known brands. Shredded Wheat, got that. Shreddies, never heard of it. And Cheerios. So one way to go global is to find a company who's already there doing well and can find a good way to create an alliance with them. There are different types of global companies. One would be called an international firm. Here, international marketing is done mostly the same way as it is done domestically. We don't do a lot of changes. Belron is a vehicle glass repair and replacement group. They operate worldwide across 34 countries. But their basic business model, their basic plan, and their jingle is pretty similar throughout the world. I would say that they're sort of in the domain of an international firm. So I don't know if you can hear it all, but that theme music, even though the language is different, is pretty similar in all the countries that they do business in, and you may also have heard it here.
Safe light repair, safe light replace.
Domestically. So, to the extent that we can argue they're doing the same business model throughout the world, pretty much in the same way as they're doing it here domestically, we would say they're an international firm, a particular strategy. We also could talk about being a multinational firm. Here, we're going to look out to the world and say, man, all those consumer markets are pretty different from one another. I'm going to try to create a marketing mix for each one of those countries. Of course, that can keep you pretty busy, but that would be a multinational firm. So we're going to vary the marketing mix in each country. We do know that Nestle's has a large global presence. And we might find a bunch of their products or brands are quite different than what we might expect them to be based on the local country that they're in. So we have Gerber, then we have Nestle's Natures, then we have Cerelac, then we have Nido, all sorts of different brands appealing to different parts of the world. I'm trying to find any other good example that might leap out to me. So again, we know Nestle's. We don't know, anybody know Maggi? You know Maggi, okay? It's a condiment you added to your flavor. Not really a huge seller here. Give me some ketchup, some mustard, some mayonnaise, not some Maggi. Magi? Say again? Maggi. Okay, thank you. I like it. I often don't know how to say words. DiGiorno, Mezzofast, Tomy. Okay, so all of these products in different brands in different parts of the world as they arguably vary their marketing mix for each country as a multinational firm. So here we have Nestle's headquarters in Vevey, Switzerland. Up there they do have centrally product positioning, branding, logo, packaging, and pricing, but they've got different stuff going on in the U.S., in France, in Italy, in Germany, and the various countries of the world. Transnational firms. Transnational firms have an approach to global marketing that says, we're going to standardize the marketing mix where there are cultural similarities. Wherever we can leave it the same across countries, we're going to leave it the same. And then where the cultures are too different, we will make adjustments. So a goal of transnational firms is to create and maintain a balanced portfolio of global brands, everything's the same everywhere, and local brands. Why? Well, imagine that you're operating in 80 countries of the world, and you decide that you're going to make 80 different versions of your product with 80 different colorings and ingredients and marketing and 80 different bottles and 80 different whatever. Whew. And it isn't necessary. Now let's back up and we do it. We say, wait a minute, these flavors could be the same across 80 countries. These bottles could be the same across 80 countries. Can you imagine the economies of scale you get, the amount of money you save, the cost reduction you get by being able to do this global stuff? And so you can take advantage of economies of scale. You can share research and development, technical features, manufacturing across these brands. So we grow our global brands, which is what we're talking about here, where possible. Where we cannot make it the same, because the local culture, local segments won't allow it, then we obtain market penetration through brand differentiation locally when we have to. Henkel is a German company with businesses in 125 countries, employing more than 50,000 people, and marketing in more than 10,000 products in the areas of laundry and home care, cosmetics and toiletries, and adhesive technologies. So let's take a look at how Henkel operates. Here's their three strategic business units, SBUs. We talked about that a long time ago. Laundry and home care, cosmetics and toiletries, technical adhesives, all under the Henkel roof. Let's take a look at one of these and how they, in the U.S., initially they were in Scottsdale, Arizona. Then they moved to Stanford, Connecticut. Not especially important. All right. So they go out and they think about the laundry and home care products market. And they say, well, our big competitors, let's see here, globally, global competitors, Procter P&G and Lieber Brothers. We go up against a model national company like Benckiser. And then we are, we would say, transnational. So let's look at one of these product categories, the hand dishwashing liquid category. How many of you guys have hand dishwashing liquid at home? You wash up some dishes? One person, two people, three people. All right. The rest of you just throw out your paper, throw out your plates. Yes. All right, so there's 90% penetration of the hand dishwashing liquid category in Western countries, so it's a huge market. It's a pretty simple product, but consumer habits do differ from country to country, and of course all those guys there are battling for market share in the different countries of the world. So the term that we're going to use for Henkel's approach is glocalization. Where we can, we're going to standardize our offering to get low-cost production, low complexity, roll out concepts quickly. Where we have to, we'll engage in differentiation. That'll allow us to be close to those consumers who have different needs, wants, and desires. It allows us to be flexible to their changing needs, and we'll get penetration in that region. So glocalization is where we have a global marketing strategy and implement marketing tactics locally as we have to. That's the idea of glocalization. Okay? So, let's return to our example. What do? They look across their offerings as they stood before they did the analysis for the hand dishwashing liquid category. And we see we've got different brand names. We've got So imagine the costs of having to create all these different versions. So they do an analysis and they ask themselves, based on what the consumers want in these different regional areas. What can we leave the same? What must we change? And here's their analysis. They said people in different areas of the country, in different countries of the world, want different brand names. We'll leave that different. And the subname, however you say, hand dishwashing liquid, that'll have to be different. But the basic concept, the payoff, the positioning, and the communication can all be the same. That part of our marketing mix can be the same no matter where we're marketing the product. Interestingly, people want different feels to their hand washing liquid. They slippery or gritty or whatever they want. So that's got to be a little different. On the other hand, we can save a lot of money because people don't especially care about the bottle shape, the logo, the lettering. There is a difference in caps, the background, the visual key, etc. So after the analysis, you can see we moved from all of these different bottle types and different caps to basically a very limited set of bottles, mass production, and really most of the caps are the same. So convergence of the different national brands into a Euro brand that respects localities where we have to. So that would be the idea of glocalization out of a big firm. And updated, Pril, launched in 51, remains the number one hand dishwashing liquid in Germany. The footprint is now global. Pril offers consumers the best in-class solution to tough stains. And in some markets such as Italy, Turkey, and the GCC states, the brand Pril is also well established as the leading automatic dishwashing brand. And I think you can buy Pril, if I'm not mistaken, here in the States as well. Anyhow, global marketing and GM from a while ago. China, we've already heard this several times by now, central to GM's global strategy. In 2010, GM sold more cars and trucks in China than they did in the US. 2017 was the sixth consecutive year that China was GM's top market. 2019, GM launched more than 20 new and refreshed models in China. It delivered more than 3 million vehicles, and Cadillac sales reached an all-time high of 214,000 units. GM's April 2020 sales in China grew back after the bit of a crash, rising 13.6%. New vehicle sales were down markedly in the U.S. in 2020, as much as 50% in some cases, but GM sales in China were the flip side of the coin, rising almost 14% in that month. So global marketing, things balance off one another. If you're only in the U.S., your sales crash by 50%. Whoops. We're global. Some things rise while some things fall. What else do we need to think about as we go global? Well, cultural diversity. What is the cultural and social environment? How about the family? How big are they? Until recently in China, how big was a core family unit? Three. They had a one-child policy, and they kept that pretty seriously. Mom, dad, one child. Now they're paying the price for that because the population was crashing, so now they have a larger policy. But if you're selling products to families, including kiddies products, there's only going to be one child at that time in family. What's it like wherever you're selling? What's that family size? Who makes the decisions in the family that where you're selling? Mom, dad? How important are the kids to the family decision-making process in the country you're selling to culturally? In the U.S., are kids pretty important or pretty unimportant in many decisions? Would you say pretty important? Pretty unimportant. Yeah, mostly, for most of our product categories, kids have a pretty big influence here. Not true everywhere in the world. So how's it work for you? What about the tastes, the customs, the behaviors? When Kentucky Fried Chicken first went into Japan, they were an early global entry into Japan. They essentially initially began by taking their product line and taking it to Japan. What do they know? And some of the changes were pretty simple. For example, they found that the Japanese thought the coleslaw was too sugary. They cut down on the sugar. They found out that in order to open a new store, you had to call in a Shinto priest, which doesn't come right away to mind as we launch a new store here in the U.S. And the Shinto priest had to adapt ancient rituals to blessing a new store to make it work. Do you, in this culture, do you give a kiss? Do you bow? Do you shake hands? How do you interact with other people if you're engaged in a meeting with them. The early U.S. manager of Kentucky Fried Chicken in Japan is shown in a video having to sit down on the floor mats in essentially a geisha house and pop down many, many sakis as part of the working with his group. It was the way they did business. Education, well, we've talked more than once by now about taking your Gerber baby products into an area where people are illiterate. So I'm just reading on the jar from the picture what you got in the can. What you got in the jar looks to me like you're serving up ground up babies. What's the education level of the population you're selling to? What does it mean for your marketing mix? Language, obviously, is one to understand. So we have to understand all of these things as we go internationally and decide what they mean for our marketing mix. What are some impediments to understanding foreign markets? Well, one is a psychological factor called self-reference criteria. The self-reference criteria is when you unconsciously use your own values, your own experiences, and your own knowledge as a basis for making certain decisions, in our case, business decisions. This can result in a failure to develop an open attitude and a cultural sensitivity that would enable managers to look carefully at foreign markets, to understand the customer's needs, and not simply transfer the needs of the domestic market over there. Hey, this is the way we do it here. I guess it'll work there. Why? What makes you think that? Well, I don't know. It just seems like that's what we do in the U.S. Not necessarily a good way to go. Also, we have the idea of ethnocentrism. Ethnocentrism is a bit worse, if you will. Ethnocentrism isn't the idea that, well, we'll just do the things there the same way we do them here. Ethnocentrism is the idea that our way of doing it is better than your way of doing it in your country. We know better. Boy, that's a way to endear yourself to a population, coming in and telling them how they should do it, things. Walmart attempted to implement its successful strategies in Japan, including its everyday low prices. Obviously, it works good here. It should work good there. That doesn't seem stupid. Well, wait a minute. This doesn't have the same value in Japan as it does in the United States because Japanese customers associate low prices with cheap quality. Why would I want to go buy a product that has cheap quality? So their local operations are struggling. They're closing stores because everyday low prices, even though it works here in America, doesn't work well in Japan. Maybe should have investigated that a little further. Nike released a set of women's sports gear inspired by traditional tatau tattoos from the Southwest Pacific. But the international sports brand made a cultural faux pas and ended up pulling the product. The women's leggings created the appearance that the world had traditional Samoan tattoo, the pei, which is reserved for men. They did not take the time to consult with those in the know. A blogger on one Samoan Facebook page called Nestle's use of the tatau an ugly exploration of culture. Another noted, to the outside world, it's just a design, but to my Polynesian people, it's sacred. What do you put it on women's leggings for? How about you check out some stuff before you make these business decisions with some folks that are relevant in the country you're talking to, eh? Also, as you think about going globally, what about the infrastructure? We thought a little bit about that when we looked at Porter's Diamond, maybe last class period. What about the country's ability to provide communications, transportation, energy for your efforts? What about the level of economic development in the country you're going into as part of the studying the economic environment? Level of economic development is a general indicator of the market's attractiveness, lets you know the types of products that will be in demand. If you are operating in a country that has a very tiny but very wealthy upper class and then a massive agrarian culture, there's not a huge, huge demand for underarm deodorant and air conditioners and cars. There's a big demand for agricultural products, fertilizer, tractors, and a teeny market for yachts and you know, jet airplanes. What is the distribution of wealth in the country you're thinking about going to? Are there some that are very wealthy, some that are very poor, and a big middle class? Has different implications, right? You could look at the gross national income per capita. Here's the rate of change of real gross domestic product across Japan, the US, the United Kingdom, and China. China looks like its GDP, although on a downward slope currently, still looks pretty good compared to these other piddling countries of the world like Japan, the US, and the United Kingdom. Competition. Oftentimes, when we go global, we forget that they've been going a long time without us. There are folks already there fulfilling that need, want, or desire. How strong are they? Who are they? What are they doing right? Who is the local competition? You've got to have a differential advantage over the local brands. For a long time, as I said earlier, Starbucks couldn't get into Italy because they were really happy with their local coffee shops, as they had been for many generations. The local competition was strong for a long time. What about things like political stability of the country you are going into? If the country is not politically stable, you risk business losses. There are a lot of different rankings out there. Let's look at some of them. These are the rankings from the globaleconomy.com economic indicator site. So here's the political stability index of all the countries of the world. At the top is a country you haven't thought of recently, probably, Liechtenstein, Andorra, Singapore, Aruba, New Zealand, Dominica, Iceland, Tuvalu, Luxembourg. And in the middle, not so stable, is Paraguay, the U.S., and Swaziland. And down at the bottom, probably shouldn't be thinking about going into Mali, Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, and Somalia. Some of those are sort of obvious, but have you thought about the political stability of the country you're going into? Invest a bunch of bucks, lose it when the country fails. Fragile states is a heat map of the world showing which are more fragile, orange, red, which are more less fragile, greens and blues. We've talked several times in class about the UN Sustainable Development Goals. How well are these countries you're thinking about getting into achieving the UN Sustainable Development Goals? So 100 would be all of the UN Sustainable Development Goals have been achieved. Finland, Denmark, Sweden, Norway are doing pretty darn good at sustainable development in their countries. Germany, France, Switzerland, Ireland, Estonia, US, 41st under this list, just behind Cuba and above Bulgaria. And we have some folks pretty far down on the list as well. How would that work for you if you're thinking about going into these countries? So what are market entry strategies? One approach: minimal involvement, indirect exporting. In fact, in indirect exporting, sometimes you don't even know you're global until somebody calls up your helpline and says, tell me about this product and why it isn't working right in my country. And you go, wait, I'm not selling in your country. Somebody on their own has decided to buy your product, wholesale perhaps, and market it under your name somewhere else in the world. That's pretty low level of involvement. Direct exporting is where you know what you're doing, but you don't have a lot of involvement. So we hire you guys to go sit in a corner somewhere, get on the phone, call up countries and see if they want any of your stuff. Direct exporting of your product, but not much involvement. Licensing requires a little more involvement with people in that country. Bless you. So you have contract manufacturing or contract assembly. I'm going to tell you how to do it. You'll do it for me under my name. But your work, you know, is mine. It belongs to me. And franchising is a light form of licensing. Joint venture, where we're working carefully with your entity. And then the most control and also the most risky is direct investment. You set up your own manufacturing plant, your own offices, your own distribution network. You're heavily invested there. You hope that country is stable and is working well. Did you have a question? Tell me a question.
Is that part of the reason we have so many retailers? Is Like, what if a brand can't get to a certain country, but a retailer can?
Well, in the U.S., you don't have very many situations where it's just a brand selling by itself. Usually they're doing it through retailers, right? Because that's the efficient way to reach them. Direct marketing from your website is a little different story. But yeah, exactly so. So it's unlikely that a brand is going to open up a brand store globally, just as it's unlikely, mostly, they're going to open up a brand store here. You find exceptions to that. One exception that comes to mind right away is any bikers here? Motorcycle riders, I mean? Nobody? All right. So anyhow, for example, Harley-Davidson does have Harley-Davidson stores, brand stores in Europe. It's really statusy if you can get a Harley over there. But in general, yeah, the retailers' stores are the way to get those brands out there. Yeah. All right, so on a chart, low involvement abroad, low risk, low control, and low profitability done by exporting directly or through import-export middlemen would be on the left-hand side of the chart. So we saw already that Ohio is one of the 10 top exporting states in the country. Exporter rank on this particular chart, number 7, importer rate number 11, total trade balance rank 38 out of 50. So I went to a import-export show one time, and I was chatting with a local company. Anybody out of Medina? Anybody from Medina? So this was Medina Garage Door Company. And I said, you're a garage door company in Medina. Why are you at an import-export trade show? And the guy said, I don't know why, but a certain segment of population in Europe love our garage doors. And so we export our garage doors to wherever it was in Europe. We want to learn more about that. Go figure. Garage doors have a preference for American garage doors somewhere in Europe. So they became exporters. And again, if you're interested in this and you're a company, Ohio is happy to provide services for you through the Ohio Department of Development for creating a better life. And at one point in time, yeah, here we go, starting and growing your business in Ohio and doing exporting. Company sales branches are a little more involved in that local area. Licensing and foreign producers or contract manufacturing by foreign producers. So Coca-Cola has lots of plants around the world that manufacture their product in their names under a licensing agreement, and they can't suddenly decide to set off and use that mix on their own to sell product. They're under a contract. And they can't suddenly also decide to sell Pepsi. They're making products for you. Joint ventures and strategic alliances, for example, GM is a global company committed to delivering safer, better, and more sustainable ways for people to get around. GM Motors and its subsidiaries and joint venture entities sell vehicles under the Chevrolet, Buick, GMC, Cadillac, and Baojun and Wuling brands. More information on the company and subsidiaries, including OnStar, a global leader in vehicle safety and security services, can be found at that site. GM and its joint ventures in China have more than 58,000 employees. GM, along with its joint ventures, offer the broadest lineup of vehicles and brands among automakers in China. Products are sold under the Buick, Cadillac, Chevrolet, Baojun, and Wuling nameplates. So they're pretty big in this approach to global markets. Wholly owned subsidiary is more involvement. And Saint-Gobain, and I thought it was amusing, at our sales and marketing careers fair, we had a representative from Saint-Gobain. Local company is Norton. Saint-Gobain is a multinational corporation in many countries of the world, high involvement abroad, high risk, high control, a high profit potential. It's not important, but I tell the true story. So I used to take, maybe I told the story. I used to take students to Europe, I've said that before, visit corporations, and we visited Saint-Gobain in La Défense outside of Paris. So we're chatting with the staff there, the corporate people, and this woman walks up and she says, where are you from again? I say, Kent State in Kent, Ohio. She says, I was just there. You were at corporate headquarters at Saint-Gobain in Paris, and you were just in Kent, Ohio? Yeah, she's the new HR person for the world, and she was traveling around seeing a bunch of their facilities, and we have facilities in and around Kent, so she was just going through Kent, Ohio, doing her job for Saint-Gobain. So anyhow, licensing and contract manufacturing by foreign producers. Coca-Cola, based, of course, in Atlanta, Georgia, operates in 200 countries, uses 300 bottling partners with exclusive rights. You can't go off and make competition products. And they deal with 50 different currencies in these countries. Coca-Cola ran into some domestic economic problems in the last recession. It meant the U.S. dollar was weaker in the world. At that time, the dollar lost 3.4% against the euro and 1% against the Japanese yen. So U.S. consumers had to pay more for imported goods. U.S. consumers didn't like that. But for Coke, weaknesses in some currencies were then offset by strengths in others. In the second quarter of that recessionary period, Coke reported a 20% increase in income, and 11% of that was due to moving currency around, getting exchange rates. Where are my finance people? Finance, finance, finance? So they're actually, they're actually back office jobs there, where what you do is work in world currency exchange rates, getting the best deal today on whatever today's currency value is across your corporation. So as a global company, Coke has distributed its risks throughout the world. Strategic alliances and joint ventures are typically set up when a business desires to edge into a related business or a new geographic market. If an organization doesn't have the capability to do what they want or need to do in coping with their global environment, they should think about a global business partnership alliance. So SAIC, General Motors Corp, we just talked about that, is a joint venture between General Motors Company and SAIC Motor that manufactures and sells all these cars in mainland China. And I actually forget where this click goes to. Let's see what it brings up. GM China, about us, what we stand together to drive the world. It looks pretty generic, though. So that's their China-related site. Saint-Gobain, multinational company, more than 1,000 companies at your service. Saint-Gobain is present in 54 countries. It's listed on the stock markets in Paris, London, Frankfurt, Zurich, Brussels, and Amsterdam. One of the world's 100 leading industrial corporations, fields a workforce of over 207,000 people. As a producer, processor, and distributor of materials, they transform raw materials into advanced products for use in our daily lives. What are some local companies? The last time I checked, Saint-Gobain Performance Plastics in Solon, Ohio, Saint-Gobain Aerospace in Ravenna, Saint-Gobain Crystals in Hiram, and on and on and on and on and on. So these guys are pretty well vested in the U.S. Hope we stay stable for them. We don't want them to lose a bunch of money here. So product strategies as you think about going global. What do they look like? Well, one approach, essentially, no change in the product that you sell. I'm guessing that our windshield company pretty much makes windshields that fit cars all over the world. It's pretty much the same, I imagine. Or another approach would be to modify the product to match the customer's differing needs, wants, and desires. In a little bit here, we'll get to McDonald's in Japan. McDonald's burger is pretty good, but they're trying to find other ways. I'm sorry, China. They're finding other ways to sell product in Japan. They come up with a Szechuan pepper patty, hot, 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 to sell in China. Might not sell well here, but apparently it was an interesting offering in China. Product invention, create an entirely new product to satisfy the needs, wants, and desires that are not being met by any current product in that country. What makes sense for you? I don't know. We got to see how it works in your potential target market. So product extension, product adaptation, product invention. Let's hear about McDonald's success. Again, they've been there for a little while in China. And we'll also hear about their rival, KFC. Rival was such an early innovator. By going to Japan first, they actually had an advantage when China opened up. So McDonald's finds itself fighting KFC in China. Let's see what they have to say. Let's see what they have to say. Come on. Let's try that one more time.
inside the McDonald's empire.
Same hamburgers, same fries, same drinks. You might think you're in Dallas or Detroit, but this is China. 2 decades ago, McDonald's was largely unknown here, except as a symbol of the decadent West. But a capitalist revolution has swept through the People's Republic. And today, mainland China, still officially communist, is home to 800 McDonald's restaurants, with 200 more in Hong Kong.
And means I'm loving it.
Jeff Schwartz is loving it too. He's CEO of McDonald's China. When you look at the map, can you imagine how many stores might be in China one day?
I don't need to look at the map to imagine that. I just look at the 1.3 billion population. You know, easily we're talking 10,000 restaurants, 15,000 restaurants as it continues to develop. So the opportunity is endless.
Yeah. Endless, but not effortless. That's why Schwartz and his boss, Tim Fenton, spend so much time in China, on the road, in the air, and on the move.
3 weeks out of four.
Fenton is president of McDonald's for Asia, the Middle East, and Africa.
Wei Xiao.
There's no one at McDonald's with more experience moving into new markets.
Mistakes we've made in the past, you don't open just one store. You get 3 or 4 or 5 deals done, build them consecutively, train the crew consecutively, so you save on the money. So when a truck goes out from the distribution center, it's not carrying one store, it's carrying the products for 3 to 5.
When McDonald's first opened in China in 1990, these streets were clogged with bicycles. But prosperity's brought an explosion in car ownership. However many headaches that may mean for Chinese drivers, McDonald's saw an opportunity called drive-thru.
Hi. Well, this is the very first drive-thru we opened in November of 2005. So it's been about 18 months. Very, very successful.
First drive-thru, not just for the company.
For anywhere in China. So anywhere at all in China. So drive-thru was a brand new concept anywhere in China.
In fact, drive-thru was such a new concept in 2005 that many Chinese didn't know how to use it.
We have a lot of traffic, and I'm walking around, they pick up the food, and then they went in the, and then they went in and parked their car, they brought the bag of food, and they went inside. And I watched this happen several times, and I said, I think we might have a problem here on how the Chinese use the drive-thru.
Which meant that Chinese crews not only had to learn how to run a drive-thru, but had to teach their customers how to use one.
They're very good about holding their hands out, that, you know, stop here. Is this something that you train your crew?
Train her crew to greet customer with the hand out of the window. This way they will train their customer of how to use drive-thru.
But still, some customers don't catch on as fast as others.
Well, he's coming in the exit side, yeah. This BMW here. That's part of the training sometimes about with a drive-thru. Yeah.
McDonald's is up to 26 drive-thrus in China so far. But if most Chinese drivers still aren't familiar with the idea, that's about to change dramatically. In 2006, McDonald's signed an agreement with the Chinese state oil company, Sinopec, granting it the right to open McDonald's stores at any of Sinopec's new and existing gas stations, 30,000 of them. The very first one, opened in July of 2006, is this store in a surprisingly run-down neighborhood outside Beijing.
Obviously, it's on the fringe, okay? It's off the beaten path of main, you know, Beijing. So it's a suburb coming out.
It's a little grittier.
Yeah, it's a little grittier, but it's like an oasis to me. I'm guessing we might be a little premature here.
Yeah.
From the McDonald's side,
yeah.
But with only upside potential.
Yeah.
That, in a nutshell, has become a key part of McDonald's expansion strategy in China. The willingness to bet on an area that may not be ready for a McDonald's yet. But with China the world's fastest growing economy, McDonald's is banking on neighborhoods like this being a good gamble.
It's really not that difficult. You look at a developing area, you see where it's going. You see the corners, you see the retail, you see the apartments and the condos coming in.
You can spot an up-and-comer.
Yeah, we've done a lot of real estate. we've done it like 34,000 times.
Tell me about what this neighborhood looked like before this store was built.
Nothing was around. These buildings right here were half built, and there was nothing behind there. But you looked at the site layout, and they said, well, the shopping mall's going here. There's going to be, 5,000 residents here, and down the street here will be another 5,000 residents. It was amazing.
But for all of China's potential, the learning curve for McDonald's here has been steep, and they've had to play catch-up. When McDonald's opened its first mainland store in 1990, rival KFC had already been there for 3 years. Today, there are more than 1,900 KFC stores in China, more than twice as many as the Golden Arches.
McDonald's has a lot of competition here in China, not all of it from big-name U.S. brands like KFC. You can find mom-and-pop food stands like these all over the country. And although dishes like scorpions and seahorses on a stick may not be your idea of a meal, here they're traditional, they're convenient, and they're cheap.
A short walk through any Chinese city reveals a kaleidoscopic array of foods, tastes, and textures. Adapting the McDonald's menu to palates used to foods like these is the job of McDonald's corporate chef, Leslie Bailey.
Now, this is the value pork burger.
He spends his days in a Hong Kong food lab that McDonald's calls the Forbidden Kitchen.
We're going to test this in 40 stores.
We've got a good picture of it.
What makes it hot? Is it the sauce or even the patty?
No, the patty itself. It's seasoned with Sichuan pepper.
That is good.
Yeah?
That is a good sandwich.
Right? With the cucumber.
Wow.
Taste, convenience, and price are important in China, just like in the U.S. But the issue here that trumps them all is food safety. It is a nightmarish problem in a developing country where corruption is rampant and safe food handling practices are still largely unknown.
How much do you live in fear of waking up some morning and seeing a headline about McDonald's food safety being called into question?
I don't live in fear of it. It's always in the back of your mind, something because of the area we live in, particularly of the history that this part of the world has had with avian influenza and SARS.
Food safety concerns are one reason all Chinese McDonald's stores have hand washing stations and hand sanitizers right out in the main restaurant. And behind the scenes, McDonald's says its stores and its Chinese suppliers, like this bun factory near Beijing, meet the same standards as those in the U.S.
Oh, they had quite an interesting venture getting up and running and learning lessons as they went globally into this very, to them, foreign country. I love some of the local competition. Seahorses and scorpions on a stick. I don't know if you can see, the scorpions are still alive and moving. Watch your tongue. How do you eat those? I don't know that. So different cultural sorts of things. I'm told that in Japan, KFC is a place you go for special occasions, like for someone's regular person's birthday, Christmas time, etc. It's really a big deal. It's special. There's a different cultural sense about KFC there than it is here. So this is McDonald's going into a foreign country. You can see a lot of things they had to learn and things they had to teach their customers as well, like how to use a drive-through. Very cool of them. All right. We talked about product changes. They did some of those. What about your promotion going globally? Well, one approach is to use the same promotion globally. I would argue that's what our friends in the windshield replacement area have done. Or you can adapt your promotions to local tastes. This is a Japanese commercial that I don't think you'd see work in the U.S., where mostly we're targeting kids and have other sensibilities.
Grand, I'm loving it. Debut.
It works for me, but I don't know if it works for most of America. So how do you adapt your promotions to local change? Or, of course, create entirely new promotions would be another way to go. When you bring these two ideas together, we see that we can use the same product with the same promotion. We would just call that globally a product extension strategy. We can adapt the product using the same promotion approach, so a product adaptation strategy. We can sell the same product, but adapt the promotion, a communication adaptation strategy. Adapt both the product and the promotion, a dual adaptation strategy, or do something entirely new and different. So we would call it a product invention strategy. What works right for you? Can't tell you. Depends on the competition, the country, the consumer. When you think about this, you also have to recognize, compared to what you're used to, your channels, say supply chain, are going to be, for you, unusually long and complex. Certainly overlearned that lesson during the pandemic, but even so, you're used to being domestic, working with domestic partners. You need some cups or plates or straws tomorrow. They pull it out of their warehouse. There it is for you. They can't do that in Zambia. Sorry, it's a problem. Countries may impose their own pricing constraints, their own taxation, tariffs, etc. You have to be aware of that as well. We haven't heard from Mueller in a while over at Timken. They're pretty savvy, pretty smart, but they ran into an interesting cultural difference for their salespeople that involved selling their product, the pricing of their product that they had to learn.
We tend to hire locals, and if you know, our business in China, we're hiring China citizens, and so they understand the culture pretty well. Our marketing communications people are Chinese, so we tend to do pretty well, I think, in terms of promotion and marketing. The one example, though, I thought of was in pricing, because one of the things that happened over the last 3 or 4 years is certain lines of our products, we had more demand in the marketplace than we could produce. And that's a nice problem to have, although you have upset customers that can't get enough product. And so we actually were talking to our sales organization about the importance of pricing. You know, you're in an environment where there's not enough product to go around. There are some customers willing to pay more to get more product. And so this pricing discussion was very important. And so with our raw material cost increases we've seen in steel and energy and all those kinds of things, price increases have been a big topic. We have to do it to survive. And we're also in the situation where demand exceeds supply for some products. And so one of the things we encountered in China is we had some salespeople that were very hesitant to do that. And I think in some of the Asian cultures, to go to a customer and communicate to them a price increase was losing face. And we didn't understand that when we talked to our sales team about that, and the feedback started to come back. And so we had to kind of go back a second time and just have an open discussion about why this was so important and how to communicate it to the customer in a way where you didn't lose face with the customer, that the customer can understand this is something we have to do so that we can continue to service you with high-quality products and services. So that was an interesting one that happened in China.
So here in the United States, we do deals with salespeople all the time. Executives do deal with salesperson. It's no big deal. We sign a contract. We're good, right? That's the way we work. In many Asian countries, when you do a deal with someone, your relationship with them is actually more important than the written contract. And you have to feel that they have respect for you and you respect them. That's having face. And it's a big deal in many Asian cultures to have a loss of face, to lose that respect in the eyes of the other person. Here, unforeseen, because it's a contract. We can work a deal. It'll be fine. No big deal for us. It was a big deal for their salespeople. Even though they were working with nationals, they would have thought they had it down. They didn't really understand the idea of changing, the need to change price for their products. So a cultural difference coming into a sales call in a B2B world that had to be dealt with because we really didn't understand the culture as well as we might have. If you find that interesting at all, so Kent State University has international business for business majors as a minor, or international business for non-business majors, or you can take a course in international business, or a course in international marketing, or if you just want to learn more about it on your own, here's some import and export training videos out there. So that's global. So we've talked quite a bit now about various high-level things, understanding the B2B consumer, understanding the B2C consumer, understanding going global, and we've talked a lot about a need to do that understanding. And in order to understand it, and we've seen in a variety of marketing the news stories, the importance of research into these things to understand the markets, the consumers, the clients. So this takes us to Chapter 8, Marketing Research, From Customer Insights to Actions. Lecture page is 115. So we need to do business and understand our consumers' information about a lot of stuff, including all those factors outside the firm that influence our consumers and influence us, those CREST factors. Anybody remember what C stood for? You. Bless you. Competition. R? Where's my lawyer? What's R? Nothing. Regulation, legal, political. E? Give me an E.
Economics.
C-R-E-S, social, T, technology. Just send it on your sheet. All right, so we need to know about these factors. What's going on? What's the trends? How's it influence our consumers? How's it going to influence us? So competition, regulation, economic, social, and technology. And how's it going to affect our consumers, whether we're talking about industrial clients, B2B, or ultimate consumers, B2C? How's it affect our consumers, and what does it mean for our marketing mix? I don't know. You're going to do based on intuition? How about getting some research involved in this sort of stuff? So here we are back to our model, still pretty high above the actual development of the marketing mix per se. We're trying to understand the consumer. We're trying to understand these external factors by doing research. So what is marketing research? It is the process of defining a marketing problem, defining a marketing opportunity, systematically collecting and analyzing information about this problem, about this opportunity, and then recommending actions to management. I assure you, research is not perfect. It is imperfect. But I don't want to base my entire career on a decision just on my judgment, just on my personal experience. I'd like to have some research, even knowing it's imperfect, to help give me some guidance before I go making these big decisions. So while it's imperfect, it does help to reduce risks in decision making. For example, how many of you guys know the Dollar Shave Club? Dollar Shave Club, you've heard of it? Anybody use them by any chance? All right, so Alex Schaefer, the senior manager of Consumer Insights at Dollar Shave Club, works with, of all folks, Prodigy, who's one of the video guest lecturers we've heard about, to do marketing research. The research guides product innovation, communication strategies, and brand positioning through insight projects that ensure the consumer is at the center of business decision-making and strategy. Amen. Alex's passion for research stems from his interest in uncovering human motivations. You remember us talking about human motivations in our model of consumer behavior? He says, at its core, research is about understanding people on a human level, why they do what they do, how they feel when they do certain things, and from a business perspective, how a brand or a product can play a meaningful role in their lives. Read, bring them value, satisfy their needs, wants, and desires. Furthermore, what research reminds me to do on a daily basis is to practice empathy. While we all practice empathy daily, I love that it's a crucial part of doing my work, and that the more I empathize with the people I'm talking to or surveying, actual or potential customers, the better insights I'm able to deliver. The most successful and impactful research I've ever done has helped decision makers put themselves in the shoes of the consumers and to build strategy from that point. The importance of understanding consumers. So, marketing research is used for planning marketing programs. Well, yes. It's also used to help us implement the programs appropriately given what we've learned about the consumer. And we use it to evaluate those programs, the success of those programs. Did they do what we needed them to do? How do we know that? We need some data against our goals. It's marketing researchers that are responsible for collecting and interpreting data that supports decision making. And part of that bigger thing about that's really huge today in the marketplace, data analytics. Have you heard of that? It's being a thing that's desirable out there. We have courses in data analytics, marketing research ties into that. It's really a current desirable skill. Now, I did say that, unfortunately, research is imperfect. It doesn't always work right. One of the very classic examples is the failure of Coca-Cola in its New Coke project. Back in the day, Pepsi and Coke are fighting against each other. Still true today. Pepsi is beginning to rise in sales over Coke sales. Oh, my goodness, what are we going to do? We come up with a new product. In blind taste tests, people preferred New Coke over Classic Coke and over Pepsi. They thought they had a winner. They went out and killed off Classic Coke and rolled out New Coke. People went crazy. They were boycotting the firm. They were attacking the walls of the manufacturing plant, corporate headquarters. People were really tied in the day to their Classic Coke. Beyond just the taste, what did Coke mean to me as a person? It was part of who I am, believe it or not. Researchers missed that. Crystal Pepsi was based on some research that said people like other pure, clear drinks like water, like ginger ale. Wouldn't they like a nice, clear product that tasted exactly like Pepsi? Anybody ever taste that, by the way? So they sell it periodically as a niche thing. Somebody brought me a bottle of this stuff. It looks like it's clear. It looks like water. And then you taste it, and it does taste like Pepsi, but the disconnect between its look and its taste is bizarre. Not a big hit. Starbucks partnered with Pepsi to sell Mazagran, a coffee-flavored bottled soda. It was a spectacular failure, described as best at tasting interesting. And then what a natural product extension for Colgate. What do you think about when you hear Colgate? Toothpaste. Wouldn't you want that in your frozen kitchen entree dinner? Somebody's not doing good research here. I'm sorry. So research isn't always good. All right, I'm not going to torture you anymore. So a couple comments. This is the end of material for mini test 6. That's on midterm 2. But don't forget about midterm 1. Okay, I'll send this all in email to you. Have a good weekend. See you next week.